new faces here. Good afternoon. It's time for us to move on with the meeting. We are at item number 7, which is an enforcement item. Public hearing, consideration of the issuance of a cease and desist order of Sheila M. Minor for the discharge or threatened discharge of waste in violation of a discharge prohibition specified by the Water Quality Control Plan of the Lahontan Region and rescission of previously issued cease and desist order number 6-91-591, Spalding Tract, Eagle Lake, Lassen County. I do have a statement that I need to read regarding these proceedings, so please bear with me. This is a time and place for the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahontan Region, to consider item 7 on the board's agenda, a public hearing for the consideration of the issuance of a cease and desist order to a public property owner for the discharge or threatened discharge of waste in violation of a discharge prohibition specified by the Water Quality Control Plan for the Lahontan Region. The order of presentation for this hearing will be as follows. Presentation by staff, testimony by discharger, testimony by public agencies, and testimony by other interested persons. All persons who wish to participate and have not yet submitted an appearance card are requested to do so. They can be found at the back of the room. Cross-examination of each witness by parties who have entered their appearance card, staff members, and board members will be allowed upon the completion of direct testimony of each witness. The board and staff counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. This hearing will not be conducted according to the technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any testimony that is reasonably relevant to the matter under consideration. The chair may impose reasonable time limits and may require groups to choose a single spokesperson. When it is your turn to speak, we ask each person testifying to come to the lectern to speak. At the lectern, please begin by stating your name, address, and whom you represent. All persons who expect to testify, please stand and raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony which you will give in this matter is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Okay, we are ready for the staff presentation now.
Good evening, Chair, board members, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Lisa Sfarelli, an engineering geologist in your South Lake Tahoe office. Tonight I'm here to talk to you regarding the proposed cease and desist order for Sheila Minor, a property owner in the Spalding Tract subdivision at Eagle Lake in Lassen County, and I have taken the oath. As you know, Spalding Tract is located in the Eagle Lake Basin, about 20 miles northwest of Susanville. And in 1984, the Lahontan Water Board adopted a basin plan prohibition against the discharge of waste containing nutrients to surface waters and groundwater in the Eagle Lake Basin to protect water quality and beneficial uses within the basin. The prohibition required compliance by September of 1989. In 1991, the Water Board issued 644 cease and desist orders to those who were who then owned property within the subdivision. The orders required the owners to cease discharge of waste containing nutrients to individual on-site wastewater disposal systems by 1993. Ms. Minor was one such property owner. At that time, however, there was no available means by which to comply. In October 2007, the Spalding Community Services District wastewater disposal system, the community wastewater system, became operational, providing the community with a readily available means to comply. And most owners have long since complied. For those that failed to do so on a voluntary basis, the Water Board has compelled compliance. This has been accomplished through a combination of progressive enforcement actions, typically beginning with notices of violation, followed by cease and desist orders, and, when necessary, administrative civil liabilities. This combination of enforcement has been effective in bringing nearly all of the remaining properties into compliance. Over 640 properties are now in compliance, so we're literally down to the last few non-compliant properties. We're almost there. Compliance is achieved in one of two ways: either connect the on-site wastewater system to the community system, or abandon it in accordance with Lassen County requirements. Today, the prosecution team is bringing one proposed CDO before you for your consideration. The proposed CDO identifies Sheila M. Miner as the owner of Lassen County Assessor's Parcel Number 077-332-4211 in Spalding Tract. It also contains findings explaining that Ms. Miner was issued one of the original CDOs back in 1991 for the same on-site wastewater disposal system. If adopted, the new CDO will rescind the 1991 CDO and establish a new compliance schedule. This is consistent with the Water Board's past actions involving other Spalding Tract property owners who had not complied with their 1991 CDOs when the Water Board adopted new CDOs establishing new compliance schedules in 2009, 2011, and 2013. It has taken the Water Board's prosecution team additional time to bring a new CDO against Ms. Miner due to challenges encountered when attempting to properly serve her a proposed CDO. This past October, Ms. Miner was successfully served the proposed CDO that is before you today. The prosecution team recommends that you adopt the proposed CDO for Sheila Miner today so that staff can finally move forward with its progressive enforcement process intended to bring Ms. Miner into compliance with the Basin Plan prohibition. Doing so will put the board in a position to impose administrative civil liability if necessary, should Ms. Miner continue to violate the prohibition. Your authority to issue the CDO is found in Water Code Section 13301, which states that the board may issue a cease and desist order when a regional board finds that a discharge of waste is taking place or threatening to take place in violation of requirements or discharge prohibitions prescribed by the board. In this case, the on-site wastewater disposal system on the property is threatening to discharge in violation of the prohibition. The evidence supporting the issuance of the CDO consists of Lassen County and Spalding Community Services District records that show the property has an on-site wastewater system that has not been connected to the community system, and staff has not received abandonment certification from the county. So we've established that Ms. Miner's property has an on-site waste disposal system that is not connected to the district system nor properly abandoned. The waste that could be discharged from such a waste disposal system contains nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus, as shown on this slide. Therefore, at a minimum, the presence of Ms. Miner's on-site wastewater disposal system presents a threatened discharge of waste containing nutrients to groundwater of the Eagle Lake Basin in violation of the prohibition. The Water Board is therefore authorized to adopt the proposed CDO and establish a new time schedule for Ms. Miner to comply. The reasons why your action is needed today are to protect water quality and beneficial uses, to achieve compliance with the Lahontan Basin Plan, to provide the necessary incentive for the property owner to comply, and to provide and ensure fair, firm, and consistent enforcement with Water Board requirements. So as I said, the CDO rescinds Sheila Miner's 1991 CDO, which I believe is the last 1991 CDO needing rescission, and requires Ms. Miner to either connect or abandon her on-site wastewater disposal system by June 30, 2015, and then by July 14, 2015, submit documentation to the board verifying compliance. And staff's recommendation is that you adopt as proposed the cease and desist order before you today. I'd like to have entered into the record the Lahontan Water Board's agenda package for this item as well as this presentation. Now we're here to answer any questions.
Any questions or staff?
I have one question. Will we need to serve her with the CDO, or is that not necessary?
I believe in the past, once they've been served the proposed and it becomes adopted, we simply mail it to her.
Thank you. I move the staff recommendation.
Second.
Is there anyone wishing to provide additional testimony on this from the discharger? A motion and a second requires a unanimous support. But since there's only four of us here today, let's do a roll call vote. Madam Clerk?
Eric Vandell?
Yes.
Kimberly Cox?
Aye.
Don Jardine?
Aye.
Peter Pumphrey?
Aye.
Thank you. That concludes item number 7. Item 8 has been pulled. And now on to item 9, marijuana regulatory program development. I know this is an item that we are all very interested in seeing the updates on.
Good evening, members of the board. My name is Scott Ferguson. I'm a supervising water resource control engineer on your staff. And this evening, we have a couple and possibly three speakers maybe to come before you and discuss what's going on in the state regarding marijuana regulation and enforcement. Chris Kerrigan, director of the State Board's Office of Enforcement, will talk about activities going on statewide basis, and then Eric Taxer from your staff will get up and talk about what we know about the activity going on a little closer to home in our own region. And there might be an opportunity also for Eldorado County Sheriff to be here a little later and provide you a little more updated information on what's going on right here in our county. So without any further ado, Chris Kerrigan will come before me.
Thank you, Scott. Good evening, honorable board members and executives. I'm Chris Kerrigan. I'm the director of the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement. And I appreciate the opportunity to address you tonight on this problem. It's sort of an emerging regulatory program. I wanted to say that although I'm the statewide lead on this, I'm working very closely with two regional boards, the North Coast Board out of Santa Rosa, and then the Reading office of the Central Valley Board. And we've split the staff up for the pilot project between the three offices so that we can really focus in on that area. And I apologize that we can't really do this on a statewide basis until we get better funding and roll it out on a broader basis. So we're focused in those areas. But I will say that in this region, my sense is, and I don't want to minimize the impacts caused by private landowners here, but my sense is in this region, many of the grows, cannabis cultivation activities, are trespass grows that take place on public lands, and consequently, they're per se illegal and inappropriate to be enrolled in a regulatory program. So we got involved in this issue because the governor's office and several legislators in the Central Valley area and on the coastal areas identified that there were significant impacts from unauthorized water diversions and then improperly operated cultivation sites. Many of the problems, and I'll show some of the sites that we've done inspections at, are associated with dirt and the movement of dirt. But there are also pesticide and rodenticide problems, there are fuel storage problems, and there are health-related problems and attendant water quality problems that are associated with people living on these sites in rural areas in ways that are not, where there's no zoning or no intention for human activities to take place there. So we have improper human waste, trash, and other things, activities being taken on in these sites as well. So in the pilot project, we worked jointly with DFW, Department of Fish and Wildlife, to prepare a strategic plan that has four main components. And the four main components are enforcement, the development of a regulatory program, education and outreach to the regulated public, and then multi-agency coordination. And all four of the components are very important. Right now, we're very heavily weighted towards the enforcement component. Regional boards are both working on developing conditional waivers of waste discharge requirements that will allow cannabis cultivators that are operating consistent with county ordinances, medical cannabis cultivators, to continue to operate and be enrolled in a permit if they meet certain conditions. And we'll talk a little bit about the various tools that we brought to bear here. It's sort of a merger of different programs that you might have familiarity with. Merger of the construction stormwater program, dairy program, and irrigated ag program. So it's kind of a combination of all of those three programs. Fish and Wildlife has 7 wardens and biologists, and we work together with the 11 staff people that we have, and we picked a multidisciplinary team. So we have engineers, environmental scientists, and geologists all working on this problem. We do a lot of fate and transport analysis, stability, soil work to make sure that erosion is okay, that slopes are properly graded, that culverts are appropriately sized. And then we work with Fish and Wildlife scientists, too, to assess the environmental impacts to fisheries and critters, because there are a lot of attendant impacts to the important species that reside in the surface waters and in the forested lands where this is taking place. So the legislature funded our pilot project for 1 year. So we're working through the first year of the project now. We're pretty much all staffed up. We've met half of our inspection target objectives and issued a number of cleanup and abatement orders to private landowners, and also done a few administrative civil liability actions. So we're rolling out the program. Even though our funding didn't kick in until July 1st, and we really didn't get staffed up until about 6 weeks after that at the Office of Enforcement. And I have a hard, dedicated prosecutor who works with local DAs and the Fish and Wildlife attorneys to develop cases and funnel them to the appropriate venue. So a lot of the work here involves coordination of the inspections and then sort of a regrouping to assess, is this a water board case where there are water implications where we can get a cleanup and abatement order out fast to the landowner and get them under order right away, while the DA may pursue criminal charges or not. And there are many counties where the DAs will not pursue criminal charges for cannabis cultivation alone. Unless there's some money laundering or drug trafficking or distribution to minors or some additional issue, in many of the northern and coastal counties, the DAs will not exercise their discretion to pursue cannabis cultivators on that basis alone. One really important distinction that I want to make explicit is our program and what we can do is focused on private lands. So since we are not a law enforcement agency, we do not do raids on public lands. We don't send our staff people, I'm just looking at Eric as an example, not that I've sent him in, but we don't send them into harm's way without a law enforcement escort or presence. We do go with them, however, in some cases to assist with assessments, damage assessments, and then also with developing remedial plans. So we have a role to play on those trespass grows on public lands, But our focus is to try to bite off that part of the problem that's occurring on private land. And it's a big problem. Believe me, there are many, many cultivation sites. Our estimate from working with the Emerald Growers Coalition and the Small Farmers Association, which are two major trade groups for cannabis cultivators, is there are approximately 50,000 cannabis gardens that raise over two dozen plants, not someone with three plants in their backyard, but two dozen plants or more in the north part of the state, so from Highway 20 up and then adding in Sonoma County. And that's kind of our focus area, Highway 20 North and then the Sonoma County and some of the coastal counties below Highway 20. So, with those sort of introductory remarks, let's see. The scope of the problem we have looked at here, the number of sites and the amount of graded land in the four watersheds where we looked to kind of try to get our arms around the scope of the problem has increased fivefold in the last 5 years. So for every 2 acres of land that was in cannabis cultivation or graded as part of a cannabis cultivation operation, in 2010, there are 10 acres in production now. And so the proliferation of cannabis cultivation is increasing very rapidly. In addition to that, there are many areas that feed into the Sacramento River Basin where cannabis cultivation was fairly rare up until 2010. But if you go out now on Cottonwood Creek and some of the other creeks that feed into the Sacramento River, you can see hundreds of sites that have sprung up along there. And the facilities that you see there vary from ramshackle trailers driven up on a vacant piece of property with a hand-dug outhouse to $500,000 homes sitting on the river with solar power. Every one of them will have a cannabis garden on it in this Cottonwood Creek area where we're looking now. So not only is the proliferation and intensity growing in the coastal areas where this was traditionally located, but it's also proliferating and expanding over to the valley, and there's no question now that it's even moving down to the valley floor. Most of the problems that we see are from a water quality perspective are associated with habitat degradation from grading or stream crossings. So a lot of the road building to get to remote sites is done in a very haphazard and unpermitted way. And so a lot of the cleanup work that we're doing with landowners where a tenant may have grown there and run off the site is associated with restoration of crossings and road work and abandonment of road work and using the forest practices rules to develop appropriate road structures. And so this kind of activity has a lot of effect on habitat and degradation of habitat. And then the unauthorized diversion of water is something that we've seen. And, of course, in these drought times, it's having a more acute effect. But I will say this, that even without the drought, we would be having impacts to species from this activity because there's so many diverters in these watersheds, so many riparian diverters in these watersheds now. So one really critical thing that we've done is we've broken down the silo between the water rights division at the state board and the regional water quality board enforcers. So on our inspections now, we not only have an engineer from the water quality side or geologist or scientist, but we also have someone from the water rights side attending these inspections so that we can do an integrated enforcement and regulatory action in this area. The Boy Scout in me hopes that we're able to do this in other programs in the future. But for this program, it's really critical to work in cooperation with the Division of Water Rights. Again, fertilizers and pesticides are often mixed with water contaminating the streams. One thing we've seen now are these big totes put up on stilts that provide an irrigation system, and they'll have two pieces of wood put together in a V that feed into the tote, and there's just pesticides and fertilizers dripping out off the toad and back into the stream. And so these are the types of things where we're going to go in and enforce best management practices in situations like this. So you can see here, we'll show you a few of the sites from the inspections we've done, primarily with the North Coast Regional Board and Fish and Wildlife. Here's a site. You can see the huge piles of detritus from the operation here in the front. The stream runs just behind the greenhouse area. Many of the cultivators now use a technique called DEPRO, or deprivation, and they run more than one crop a year by depriving the plants of light during the normal time when they'd be growing so that they can harvest two times per year. And so the intensity of the agricultural use on these properties is much like it might be in the Salinas Basin, where you would have three, four crops of lettuce per year. Here they're using the same area to produce two, three crops of cannabis per year, except here all the soil and all the materials are imported. None of these native soils are suitable for cultivating crops. Another shot from an inspection. A lot of the stuff we see is runoff associated, and then you can just see the site is just a mess. Another issue that I haven't really mentioned yet is unpermitted timber conversion. There's a lot of timber harvest and land clearing that's done without a permit. In Trinity County, the word got out that CAL FIRE was going to enforce the permitting requirements. So everybody that's cultivating cannabis in this one watershed there, they all have timber conversion permits. So in order to target our inspection efforts there, we just pulled all the permits, did an aerial flyover, and identified 17 parcels in this watershed where we'll roll out some inspections. But they all look like this. This is an unauthorized timber conversion. And we all working very closely with CAL FIRE, too. So CAL FIRE, although not a named partner or a funded partner, much to their chagrin, in this effort, we are cooperating very closely with them. Again, sedimentation, you can see the big cut there. All that dirt is in the stream to the left from this pad area. And this is an area where it was a road surface for access. And then afterwards, it just became an area where the detritus from the spoiled soils were stored. Here you can see the chocolate water running, very common after any particular rain event below the sites. And of course, it's a way to track to where it's coming from. A lot of badly graded slopes. Too, where you see the big rivulets from the runoff, and of course all that sediment is being deposited in our surface waters. And as you're, I'm sure, well aware, salmonids are severely impacted by sediments in their habitat. So this is really detrimental to the streams. Here's an illegal diversion. We see the weirdest and most kind of fly-by-night diversions. This is reroute. This is a bunch of plastic on sort of a makeshift dam that's acting as a diversion dam. And as you can see here, it's diverting more than 50% of the stream. And this is completely unauthorized. So, and you see places here, all the fish that would be in this stream are being diverted away into the cultivation site, any of the upstream fish that are present in the stream. You know, this is the kind of thing we see, this human waste near water that houses the folks that are doing these grows. This is a particularly large site. Again, this is like year two, but this is the kind of thing that we see when we go to these sites. This guy's diverting the septic from his outhouse directly to the stream. So the impacts that we're seeing are severe and, for the most part, unnecessary. These types of things don't have to happen to have a successful business plan to engage in this activity on these types of properties. So what we're going to do, as we do with any new regulatory program, is weed out those who will cooperate with us and be responsible stewards of the land and as they engage in their activities, from those who are just out to make a fast buck, which is basically what you saw on all the photographs of the sites that we had there. And as we coordinate with local sheriffs and law enforcement, people who refuse to cooperate with us will become the subjects of law enforcement-based prosecutions, while those who do cooperate with us will become the subjects of a regulatory program. And so the choice is fairly obvious, in my view, and yet we're still going to have a very difficult time ferreting through these groups as we get out in the field in the first instance, because this is a heretofore unregulated activity, and the law enforcement model has just not worked. I mean, despite the millions and millions and millions of dollars that have been poured into this by the federal and state government to try to eradicate this activity, it's five times greater now than it was in 2010. So this is a different approach that we're trying somewhat out of desperation, but also these are the tools, as you know, that we know how to use. And so we can bring the tools that we know how to use to bear and try to solve our part of the problem or be part of the solution. You know, this is a slide I'm sure you're sure with, or I'm sure you're familiar with, but I wanted to use it to show that we're kind of from Clear Lake North there is where the pilot project is located and where we're focusing our resources. Now, I do send my special investigation unit out into the field in other areas for site-specific work. So they'll go to Santa Cruz or Big Sur. They'll come up to this region if we have sites where they're needed. But I keep my cannabis unit focused in the pilot project area. And what we're doing now is we're shifting from complaint-driven enforcement to watershed-driven enforcement. So what we've done is we've identified, and I won't name them by name, five watersheds that we're going to move into and sub-watersheds between now and the end of the pilot project, where there are approximately 200 property owners. And in each of those, it's salmonid habitat, salmonid habitat, or a drinking water supply that dried up last year for the first time in memory. And so we're going to go into those watersheds and try to solve the problem with the regulated public. All of those watersheds are also where there are the property is 90% or more, the adjacent properties to the streams is 90% or more private land. And so in each of those cases, we feel we have a very high chance of success of rolling out our regulatory program, weeding out the bad actors, and developing a sustainable ecological model in the stream that's there. Also, from a water rights perspective, since all the diverters in these streams are similarly situated, they're all riparians, there's no other right involved, our enforcement authority is more nimble with respect to doing curtailments. So the four keys to our program, again, targeted enforcement that is proactive, not reactive. That's what we want to do, because if you just go out reactively, it's just like pushing in on a beanbag. It comes out somewhere else. So we want to go in, solve in a sub-watershed, then move to the next one. Develop the regulatory program. The conditional waivers are underway. I've seen drafts of them. They have BMPs that relate to pesticide use, fuel storage, grading, stream setbacks, all kinds of different conditions that are imposed on the activity. And then there's a site management plan component, which is much like the dairy program, so that you're basically demonstrating as a member of the regulated public that you're doing as much as you can to keep your site from contributing to the pollution or water supply problems. And then we're going out and rolling that out. I've done 60 interviews with media so far, and a bunch of stakeholder meetings, probably a dozen or more stakeholder meetings, trying to get the word out that we're coming. And they always want to know, well, where are you going to go first? And I said, I'm going to be everywhere first, so be ready because I will be there. And so then they say, well, what do you want me to do? So we're getting that BMP information out on the websites before the permits are adopted. You know, with a caveat, because there are going to be additional BMPs and they're going to be tweaked. But as you know, with the BMP approach, best management practices approach, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. You pick from suites that work for your site. So again, educating cannabis cultivators about how to implement BMPs is a challenge, but I have some very skilled staff people who are really engaged with the education and outreach component. And then I spend a lot of my time coordinating with sheriffs, district attorneys, code enforcement officials. You saw the privy that I showed earlier. We do go with our inspections. We are willing to and cooperate with code enforcement if they want to come with us. We put them on the warrants and go to the properties with them. Oh, and by the way, I should say, we always ask for consent to enter a property first, but we also have the warrant in our back pocket if consent is not granted. And so I do a lot of work with state and local agencies because this won't work if we don't have the cooperation of our local partners. And every county has a different perspective on how to address medical cannabis in their communities. And when you go from Humboldt to Butte to Alpine to El Dorado County, every county has a different approach and perspective. And so it's really critical for us when we go out in the field to understand what that is. So in Humboldt County, when we go out there, we know we're not going to be eradicating plants unless there's some other criminal activity going on there. In Butte County now, they passed an ordinance where it's not legal to grow outdoors, with a minor exception. So we have to understand that those regulatory issues when we go out in the field, and then we also have to understand those when we decide how to prosecute cases. So again, I talked a little bit about this. The stormwater toolbox is not really enough. We can't require people to enroll under the construction general permit because it doesn't address a lot of the other issues that are present at these sites. But if you look at the combination of stormwater, construction stormwater, dairy, and irrigated ag, you can come up with a pretty good approach to regulating these types of sites. Basin plan prohibition is not really an appropriate regulatory tool. It's too cumbersome and not necessarily financially viable approach. As you know, basin planning is a very cumbersome process. But WDRs and conditional waivers, we're pretty nimble with those, and they have to be revised every 5 years. It's also very likely that we would revise this conditional waiver potentially sooner than that because we're shooting in the dark. I mean, this is a completely new activity to go out and try to regulate. One thing I wanted to point out about Water Code Section 13304, our cleanup and abatement authority, as you may know, it's pretty much strict liability for landowners and operators. If you own a property where there's a condition of pollution or nuisance, or you were an operator that caused or contributed to that condition, you're strictly liable to clean it up. And so here we look at three types of potentially responsible parties to issue cleanup orders to. Owners, for sure, got to work with the owners because many times the operators are transient. Operators, for sure, if you can get them. And in this case, especially in the coastal counties, we frequently have people who have been in this business for a long time and they're not going anywhere. So we have owners, operators, and then contractors. There are lots of contractors who do grading, road grading, pad grading, and other things, and essentially they did the do. They are the people who caused the condition of pollution or nuisance. They're the agents of the owner, but they did the grading. And in many cases, this is unpermitted grading and grading that's substandard pursuant to a license. So in one of the first five cleanup and abatement orders we issued, we named the grading contractor. Part of our education outreach is we just recently mailed out flyers to all the Class B grading contractors in the North State saying, you could be liable, this guy was. And then we also talked a lot about the public and private land distinction with respect to our regulatory involvement. So there are some serious challenges to this regulatory program. The most significant of which will come, I think, from an historical perspective, is that this is illegal under federal law, under the Controlled Substances Act. And so that's why people grow cannabis out in the woods where they can't be seen, instead of down in the valley like a row crop. And consequently, we see these adverse impacts in areas where the carrying capacity and the structure of the land is not fit for the activity. And so that's caused kind of a problem. The economic model is skewed because the product is illegal under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. But I've been meeting very closely with federal officials, and so far I have the thumbs up for our project. And also a promise that they'll let me know if the thumb starts to turn sideways. So the federal government basically is interested in trafficking, distribution to minors, and other types of issues that are more associated with crime and organized crime, not medical cannabis cultivators. And so they basically, their thought at this point, and this is memorialized in a memorandum from Attorney General Holder, is that in states where cannabis is legal medically, if the state has a regulatory program in place and is addressing the health and safety issues in its state, we're going to be focused on these other issues. And so far that's panning out. And as far as our enforcement authority at the Water Board, not just as the state of California, we really need a viable business operator with an intent to continue in business, or a landowner that has some desire to preserve his or her property value for our regulatory program and enforcement programs to function and work. The somewhat surprising thing is there are a lot of cannabis cultivators out there who fit into this category. There are many who don't, but there are a lot who do. Additional considerations with the program that we've worked with Cal EPA and the governor's office and the other BDOs or the other offices. Hazardous waste and chemical removal is a really big cost, especially on trespass grows. There are political issues with how we're going to be able to fund orphan sites and cleanups at orphan sites. The thought was we should use the penalty money for that, but there's court cases that say you can't be a bounty hunter and support your program in that way. And so we could put penalty money into a pot that the legislature could subsequently allocate, but all these things are up in the air. But I will say we're having those discussions now at the governor's office and with the legislators, because this is going to be a big problem, how to address orphan sites where folks get a tip that law enforcement's coming on a trespass site, no one gets caught, everybody's gone, and there's a big nuisance there. Another problem is enforcing illegal water diversions is, for me, very unsatisfying because the penalties are weak. Even the enhanced penalty for cannabis cultivators that do illegal diversions that came as part of the drought legislation come nowhere near the type of a penalty authority that we have under the Port of Cologne to issue water quality-based fines. Fortunately and unfortunately, we haven't really seen a site where we only have a water diversion issue. All the sites have water diversion and water quality issues. And so a combined enforcement effort works, but oftentimes the most acute problems in the stream are resulting from the diversions. So that's a challenge that we'll have to overcome as we implement the program. And then, as I said, the migratory nature of growers is related to the fact that it's illegal under the Controlled Substances Act. And then program sustainability is an issue. Right now, our funding is by the grace of the legislature, but as budgets change and as time goes on, that's going to evaporate, and we get a lot of questions already about fees and how we will support this regulatory program independently. And that has been the Water Board's model. It's an effective model because we're in charge of our own destiny. There are greater costs with rolling out this program than other programs because of the high enforcement component and because it's a brand new program. Hopefully we'll get to an asymptotic point where we're able to sustain this with fees from permittees. So with that, I don't know if you want to hold questions till Eric makes his presentation, or I'm available for questions.
Let's do questions. Any other? No questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Chris. Good evening, Madam Vice Chair, members of the board. I'm Eric Taxer, Water Resource Control Engineering, Lake Tahoe Office and the Enforcement Unit. I'm going to discuss some of our region-specific issues that we have with marijuana grows. As Chris noted, the overall emphasis from the state board perspective is to address the marijuana grows on private lands. With respect to public lands, Water Board staff will be providing a technical assistance role when it comes time to addressing remediation needs. And in our region, we have many public landholders. Please? There we go. So, our landholders include the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, state and national parks, and Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. There's quite a bit of public land ownership within our region. So when I was first assigned the task to assess water quality impacts in our region, I thought, you know, being Pollyanna and everything, I thought, please, who can possibly grow marijuana in our high mountain areas or in the arid desert areas? I was surprised. I surveyed law enforcement officials throughout our region, and every single county in our region is impacted adversely by these outdoor trespass grows. They're typically conducted by drug trafficking organizations or cartels. Some of these sites are as high as 10,000 feet in elevation. We have sites in our arid desert regions. Everywhere that you think of, there are marijuana grows. So here's an example in Alpine County. There have been several seizures and confiscations over the years, some up around Heenan Lake area, Highway 88, Highway 4 areas. One of the cartels or the drug trafficking organizations will try to seek very far out of the way places for their grows. They basically want to be under the radar screen from law enforcement and from passersby. So obviously there's going to be the impact of the road grading to access these sites, but it's no problem for them because they have access to very cheap labor. Once they're in these sites, there's environmental impact. They commonly used numerous pesticides, rodenticides, herbicides. A lot of them are banned substances. There are materials that have been banned in this state, in this country, and then they're illegally imported from south of the border, if you will. And while these large-scale operators will protect their growth in any way possible, in any measure possible, there's an interesting story from a wastewater treatment plant operator in our Victorville area who was hiking the hills outside of that, in around Lake Arrowhead, I believe, last summer, and accidentally came across a marijuana grow without knowing it. He didn't realize it was a grow until he was looking down the opposite end of the barrel of the gun. But fortunately, he was able to get out of that situation. So, but that begs the question, what did these mountain grows look like? Here's an example from Mono County from a couple years ago. This site contained 30,000 marijuana plants. It was about a mile and a half in length and had street value of over $100 million at the time. Typically, these areas can be identified by it's a cleared area in an area that should not normally be cleared. There'll be signs of fertilizer bags, pesticide bags, other chemical signs of chemical use on the area. There'll be the black plastic piping that is used to illegally divert water from nearby streams. That's another interesting story that I learned from law enforcement, is that there's a correlation between the ideal spot of being appropriately hidden and off the beaten path, yet close enough to a Home Depot. So, go figure on that. They also contain large campsites that just seem out of place for the area. And Chris had some interesting photos on that. Obviously, they'll be actively growing marijuana sites or marijuana plants. So these sites routinely desecrate our environment. They produce immense amount of garbage from the campsites, from the chemical use, the fuel use, human waste, and whatnot. Here's a site that was confiscated in Inyo County a couple years ago near the Lone Pine area. From this site alone, over 2,000 pounds of trash were removed. A lot of it was hazardous material and required the response of a hazmat team to adequately remove the material. Although this is a fortunate site because they were able to remediate it. A lot of our sites are in such remote areas that it is very costly for our public landholders to adequately fund appropriate remediation for those areas. We have some sites where there are still remaining chemicals located near the streams that is just too expensive for our landholders to adequately remove. They just don't have the access to the cheap labor that the cartels do. Here's another site in Kern County on the Walker Pass trailhead. Again, chemical use, garbage, black piping, whatnot. Interesting anecdote, too, on the illegal stream diversions. What people tend to do is when they do dam up the streams, they'll mix the fertilizers in the ponded water and directly irrigate the crops from that ponded area. So whatever water is not used or is overflows, basically, it will just get flushed down the stream and then impact the fisheries downstream from that ponded area. And then our desert area is not immune to this. Last October, there was a rather significant marijuana bust in the Uary Springs, Hinckley, Apple Valley area. It was basically an organized group, drug trafficking organization, that was cultivating and processing marijuana to be shipped across the country to states as far east as Rhode Island, Route 6. So that was a rather significant bust that occurred recently. And sites like this present a danger to staff who stumble across them. This is an example of the amount of weapons that was seized from just one grow site in the Hesperia area. It was a grow site that was only 169 plants. You know, so you can imagine what kind of weaponry would be involved for a 30,000 plant grow site. So in our desert area, you know, how do you hide a grow site when you don't have a mountain canopy? So you build these really tall plywood fences to surround the boundary of your site. And allegedly that prevents people from looking in. How effective that is, I don't know, but that's what is done. So there are obviously environmental impacts, and there's also wildlife impacts in our area. Just the sheer amount of chemicals and the deticides, pesticides that are used by these growers to deter infestation and predation on their sites is immense. These are growers who use banned substances, and they don't pay attention to the labels on the substances with respect to adequate, proper use, if there even is a label on these imported chemicals. So they're using these chemicals at such a high rate that it is adversely impacting our wildlife. So the Forest Service conducted a study on the fisher species in our region, or within the Southern California area. They selected the fisher because it's considered an umbrella species in that it shares the same habitat and prey as other species that are facing endangerment. They use radio tracking to determine where the fishers are coming in contact with the rodenticides. And through that radio tracking process, they very cleverly narrow down illegal marijuana grows as the source of the rodenticides. So the fishers were documented to die at a rather high rate from either directly ingesting the rodenticides or by ingesting prey that had previously consumed the rodenticides. Also at low dose exposures, it predisposed the fishers to dying of other causes. low-dose exposures will impair their ability to heal from injury. It'll create neurological impairment and slows their reflexes. So then subjects them to becoming the source of food for other animals, dying by predation or dying by roadkill. So, but again, it's an umbrella species for other species that are facing endangerment, specifically in our region. The American pine marten and the wolverine share the same habitat and prey as the fisher. By increasing the amount of pesticide exposure and rodenticide exposure to these animals, it is adversely impacting their recovery rate in our area. Also, the high Sierra fox has been documented in our region rather recently, down in the Sonora Pass area of Alpine County. And, you know, because of climate change, the desert fox, or the high Sierra fox, is seeking higher ground. It's coming up, it's becoming more prevalent in our area. Oddly, because of climate change, marijuana growers seem to be expanding in our area as well. That was an interesting story by many of the law enforcement agencies I spoke to. We're seeing a longer growing season, and we also have a more readily supply of water. You know, we have a more reliable source of water for their crops. So we're beginning to see sort of a butting heads, if you will, or a conflict between additional marijuana grows and wildlife impacts. So what are we doing about it? We recognize that we have a problem, and it's a rather interesting problem to solve. It's not an issue where we can issue a permit to illegal drug trafficking organizations. So we want to address this by working cooperatively with our public landholders. We sent out a letter requesting such cooperation, and we've been getting some pretty positive responses to that. Our landholders do care about water quality, obviously, and the environment, and they want to work with us as best as they can. So our goal is to first identify where marijuana grows have occurred or are occurring, in a discreet way, of course, and to figure out what the associated water quality impacts are from those grow areas. Once we determine those impacts, our goal is to prioritize those and then come up with a strategy, figure out how we're going to remediate those sites and fund that remediation. That's going to be the tricky part of the funding mechanism. But it's going to take some time to go through this, but we're in the beginning stages of this process. So if you have any questions, Chris and I are both here to do our best to answer your questions.
Any questions? I have a question. So I guess sounds like we're getting more and more grows across the state. So I'm kind of wondering why that is. I mean, if it's actually a little bit more legal now, because you can grow for medical purposes, and potentially coming up, maybe that's going to expand to recreational grows too, I'm not sure. But why would that expand the grows? I mean, does it make it more safe to grow for shipping out to other states? Is that what's really going on? Because I don't think the market is that huge, or is it?
It's an interesting question, and there's a lot of speculation about it, but probably the best source is the federal and state law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. And their theory is that there's increased demand, and instead of cartels growing in South America and Mexico and importing over the border, they come here and grow in California now. Mm-hmm. So it apparently...
And then ship across the country, or
Then they ship it across the country. But it's also, this isn't unique to California. I mean, but California is the best place to grow anything.
in, you know, I mean, it's the breadbasket of the United States. So the two theories for law enforcement is it's cheaper and easier for cartels to come here and grow than to grow in Mexico and try to bring it across the border. And so what was being cultivated there in years past is being cultivated here now. And then there's also an assertion by law enforcement that demand in America is higher than it has been in previous years. So, but, you know, to me, it's a problem that's not going to go away, and we're kind of charged with do what you can to protect the resources, and hence we're finding ourselves in this position.
Do you happen to know if just, like, price-wise, are the cartels able to sell for a lot cheaper than the dispensaries? I mean, like, is the market totally different markets? I'm just curious if you know.
You know, I mean, I don't, but I'll say this.
In the stakeholder meetings, there's grumbling and complaints that in some communities at harvest time, the price is really low. So, for example, apparently the wholesale price in Nevada City in December is about $1,000 a pound, whereas it could be $4,000 a pound on average, and in Chicago it's $15,000 a pound for the same stuff. So, you know, I mean, I don't know the answers to those questions, Kim, but this is the kind of things that I hear.
Right. Well, I just think it's interesting because it's, you know, obviously the economics play a huge role in why people are doing this and what they're doing in order to make that happen. And it's
I have a question. As these pilot programs roll out and you increase the pressure on legal grows, do you think that will increase or decrease illegal grows, particularly in this region where we have a more stable source of water?
My sense is that my hope is that law enforcement can become more efficient in the allocation of their resources if we can pull 50,000 grows out of their purview and put them into a regulatory program. So, but there's no question that there's still a role for the law enforcement model, and a very big role. But the problem with I mean, Butte County outlawed outdoor grows. Has that changed the number of outdoor grows in Butte County? No. There are five times more outdoor grows in Butte County now than there were 5 years ago. So the law enforcement model on a standalone basis is not going to work. So the only way, well, again, I mean, these kinds of questions are for the governor's office to decide. Does it make, and the people of the state, does it make sense to have it legal so it's not economically viable to grow it and sell it on the black market? Maybe. Right? I mean, in Grass Valley, where it drives the economy, it's super cheap. And there are no cartels growing in that area because they can't sell there. I mean, if they're growing in that area, it's all going out east. So, and that's what the feds are interested in enforcing against, too. So, the price of the product is driven by its illegality. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, but again, these are policy type questions that it's up to the leaders in our state to decide what to do about. What can we do as the water board? You know, you saw what we think we can do and what role we can have in being part of the solution. I mean, I reviewed three bills since January 1 for legalization that are going to be proposed in the legislature or get shot down this year. You know, one's for Alcohol Beverage Control Commission to be an umbrella agency, one's to dump everything on the county public health departments. I mean, people are thinking about preparing to have framework in place for the 2016 ballot initiative, which will seek legalization for recreational use. So I don't know.
And do you think that will reduce the illegal grows by having it legal?
I think it will, yeah. It'll reduce the price. It'll force people to go somewhere else. It'll make it, I mean, there'll be no. So here's the thing. If you grew cannabis in
the Central Valley on flat agricultural land where they grow corn or tomatoes now, you could grow massive quantities of super high quality cannabis for a really low price. Because this stuff is all individual plant container gardens out in the woods. You know, there's just, this isn't agriculture the way they grow it now. So if this was grown as an agricultural commodity, the price would go way down. But you can't grow it that way now for fear of federal prosecution. So again, I mean, this is just the reality of the dynamic, because the product is a controlled substance. And you know, another part of the economics is it's economically cheaper and less risky to come and grow here if you're a drug trafficking organization than it is to try to come across the border. So, you know, those are two things, you know, dynamics that are in play. From what I've gleaned in my discussions.
Any other questions? What an amazing social problem.
Yeah, I agree. It's a real conundrum, and it's going to be something that we're going to have to come to grips with, or we're going to lose critical species. I mean, the fish is really imperiled now. And again, we found rodenticides that are not legal in California that are, you know, commonly used in areas where you wouldn't even be able to detect human presence, really. I mean, without, you know, a detailed study. So.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation.